Buddy love. The classic buddy story is a type that I think of as a creation of the movie age. Though there were a few great buddy tales, Don Quixote for example, this category really didn't take off as a story form until the dawn of cinema. My theory is that the buddy movie was invented by a screenwriter who realized that his hero had no one to react to. There was just this big empty space where interior monologue and description is found in fiction. And the screenwriter suddenly thought, what if his hero had someone to debate important story issues with? Thus, the classic buddy movie was born. And from Laurel and Hardy to Bob Hope and Bing Crosby to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid to the antics of Wayne's World, both one and two, it has become a movie staple. Two guys talking to each other like 48 Hours. Two girls talking to each other like Thelma and Louise. Two fish talking to each other like Finding Nemo. They all work because stories of me and my best friend will always resonate. Again, they're very human and based on universal circumstances. These are stories you can pitch to a caveman, and both he and his buddy will get it. The secret of a good buddy movie is that it is actually a love story in disguise. And likewise, all love stories are just buddy movies with the potential for sex. Bringing Up Baby, Pat and Mike, Woman of the Year, 2 Weeks' Notice, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days are, genre-wise, just sophisticated Laurel and Hardy movies where one of the buddies is wearing a skirt. And yet the rules for these, drama or comedy, sex or no sex, are the same. At first, the buddies hate each other. Where would they have to go if they didn't? But their adventure together brings out the fact that they need each other. They are, in essence, incomplete halves of a whole. And realizing this leads to even more conflict. Who can tolerate needing anybody? Penultimately, the all-is-lost moment, more on this in Chapter 4, which occurs toward the end of each of these stories is separation, a fight, a goodbye, and good riddance. That is, in reality, none of these. It's just two people who can't stand the fact that they don't live as well without each other, who will have to surrender their egos to win. And when the final curtain comes down, they have done just that. Often, as in Rain Man, one of the buddies is the story's hero and will do all or most of the changing, i.e. Tom Cruise, while the other buddy acts as a catalyst of that change and will do slight or no changing, i.e. Dustin Hoffman. I have been in many story discussions about this dynamic. Whose story is what it very often boils down to. Lethal Weapon is like that to an extent. It's Danny Glover's story. Mel Gibson is the agent of change. And though Mel will not be suicidal by the story's end, it's Danny Glover whose transformation we care most about. These catalyst buddy love tales, in which a being comes into one's life, affects it, and leaves, is a subset of the buddy love dynamic, and an important one to keep in mind. Many boy and his dog tales are like this, including E.T. If you're writing a buddy movie or love story, either drama or comedy, the dynamics of the buddy love structure are a must to know. Sit down with a dozen of these, pop them into your DVD player, and get ready to be amazed by how similar they all are. Is this stealing? Is Sandra Bullock ripping off Katharine Hepburn? Should Cary Grant's estate sue Hugh Grant for copyright infringement? Of course not. It's just good storytelling. And the beats are the same for a reason. Because they always work. Why done it? We all know that evil lurks in the hearts of men. Greed happens. Murder happens. And unseen evildoers are responsible for it all. But the who is never as interesting as the why. Unlike the Golden Fleece, a good why done it isn't about the hero changing. It's about the audience discovering something about human nature they did not think was possible before the crime was committed and the case began. Like Citizen Kane, a classic why done it, the story is about seeking the innermost chamber of the human heart and discovering something unexpected, something dark, and often unattractive, and the answer to the question, why? Chinatown is perhaps the best why done it ever made, and a textbook example of great screenwriting. It's one of those movies that you can see 1,000 times and drive deeper into smaller and smaller rooms of the Nautilus shell with each viewing. What makes it a great why done it is what makes all classic why done it's work. From China Syndrome to All the President's Men to JFK to Mystic River, every detective story or social drama, these stories walk on the dark side. They take us to the shadowy part of the street. and the rules are simple. We in the audience are the detectives, ultimately. While we have a surrogate or surrogates on screen doing the work for us, it's we who must ultimately sift through the information, and we who must be shocked by what we find. If your movie is about this type of discovery, take a look at The Great Why Dunnits. Note how a surrogate on screen represents us, and see why the investigation into the dark side of humanity is often an investigation into ourselves, in an M.C. Escher kaleidoscopic reptile eating its own tail kind of way. That's what a good Why Dunnit does. It turns the X-ray machine back on ourselves and asks, are we this evil? The Fool Triumphant. The Fool is an important character in myth and legend and has been forever. On the outside, he's just the village idiot. But further examination reveals him to be the wisest among us. Being such an underdog gives the Fool the advantage of anonymity and also makes everyone underestimate his ability, allowing him or her the chance to ultimately shine. The Fool in the movies goes back to Chaplin, Keaton, and Lloyd. Little men, silly men, overlooked men, who triumph by luck and pluck and the specialness that comes from not giving up despite the odds. In modern movies, Dave, being there, Amadeus, Forrest Gump, and many of the movies of Steve Martin, Bill Murray, and Ben Stiller come to mind as examples of how this tradition has evolved and why it will always have a place. The operating principle of the Fool Triumphant is to set the underdog fool against a bigger, more powerful, and often establishment bad guy. Watching a so-called idiot get the goat of those society deems to be the winners in life gives us all hope and pokes fun at the structures we take so seriously in our day-to-day lives. Thus, no establishment is too sacred to be skewered, from the White House, Dave, to success in the business world, the jerk, to the overblown reverence for the importance of our culture, Forrest Gump. The working parts of a Fool Triumphant movie are simple. An underdog who is seemingly so inept and so unequipped for life that everyone around him discounts his odds for success, and does so repeatedly in the setup, and an institution for that underdog to attack. Often the fool has an accomplice, an insider who is in on the joke and can't believe the fool is getting away with his ruse. Salieri and Amadeus, the doctor and being there, Lieutenant Dan and Forrest Gump. These characters often get the brunt of the slapstick, the guy at the end of the Rube Goldberg chain of events the fool sets into motion, who ultimately gets the pie in the face, like Herbert Lohm in The Pink Panther. Their crime is being close to the idiot, seeing him for what he really is, and being stupid enough to try to interfere. Special fools, whether they're in comedies or dramas like Charlie and Awakenings, offers a glimpse of the life of the outsider. We all feel like that at times. And tales of the Fool Triumphant give us the vicarious thrill of victory. Institutionalized. Where would we be without each other? And when we band together as a group with a common cause, we reveal the ups and downs of sacrificing the goals of the few for those of the many. Thus, the genre I call institutionalized tells stories about groups, institutions, and families. These stories are special because they both honor the institution and expose the problems of losing one's identity to it. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is about a group of mental patients. American Beauty is about a group of modern suburbanites. MASH is about the American military. The Godfather is about a mafia family. Each has a breakout character whose role is to expose the group goal as a fraud. Jack Nicholson, Kevin Spacey, Donald Sutherland, and Al Pacino, respectively, carry this role in these films. The reason I've dubbed these stories institutionalized is that the group dynamic these tales tell is often crazy and even self-destructive. Suicide is Painless, the theme song of MASH, isn't so much about the insanity of war as the insanity of the herd mentality. When we put on a uniform, be it the uniform of the army or a comfortable cotton shirt with a little polo player over the pocket, we give up who we are to a certain extent. And these movies are all about the pros and cons of putting the group ahead of ourselves. Again, this is a very caveman kind of story. Loyalty to the group sometimes flies in the face of common sense, even survival, but we do it. And we have done it forever. To watch others fight that battle, just like we do every day, is why this genre is so popular and so primal. Often movies of the institutionalized category will be told from the point of view of a newcomer. He is us, a virgin who is new to this group and who is being brought into it by someone who is more experienced. Jane Fonda in 9 to 5 and Tom Hulce in Animal House are examples. For any world in which the technology, lingo, or rules are not familiar to the average viewer, these characters can be invaluable relayers of exposition. They can literally ask, "How does that work?" and allow you to explain the importance to everybody. It's a way to show what is often a crazy world to us civilians. Ultimately, all the stories in this category come down to a question. Who's crazier, me or them? All one need do to understand how sacrificing oneself for the group can be an insane proposition is to check out Al Pacino's face at the end of Godfather 2. Here's a guy who has committed suicide for the good of the family and tradition. And look where it got him. It's just as shocking as Kevin Spacey's last-minute discovery in American Beauty, and mirrors almost exactly Jack Nicholson's blank post-operative expression in Cuckoo's Nest. Why? Because it's the same movie, with the same message told in extremely different and moving ways. But they all work for a reason, because each movie followed the rules. And they gave us the same thing, only different. Superhero. The superhero genre is the exact opposite of dude with a problem and can best be defined by its opposite definition. An extraordinary person finds himself in an ordinary world. Like Gulliver tied to the beach by the Lilliputians, a superhero tale asks us to lend human qualities and our sympathy to a super being and identify with what it must be like to have to deal with the likes of us little people. No wonder so many brainy geeks and teens read comic books. They don't have far to go to get in sync and identify with what it's like to be so misunderstood. This genre goes beyond stories about guys in capes and tights, however. It is more than the Marvel Universe or the DC Comics characters. Gladiator and A Beautiful Mind, both Russell Crowe vehicles, another, interesting, are good examples of human superheroes that are challenged by the mediocre world around them. In both those films, it is the tiny minds that surround the hero that are the real problem. Don't they get it? Well, no, they don't. That's why being special is so difficult. Frankenstein, Dracula, and X-Men are the same in this regard. Ultimately, all superhero tales are about being different, a feeling with which even we Lilliputians can identify. Born into a world he did not create, the superhero must deal with those who are jealous of his unique point of view and superior mind. And from time to time, we all feel this way. Anybody who has ever been shot down at the PTA or sneered at for bold thinking in a meeting at work can identify with Frankenstein's monster being chased by an angry mob of mouth breathers with pitchforks and torches. The problem of how to have sympathy for the likes of millionaire Bruce Wayne or genius Russell Crowe is solved by stressing the pain that goes hand in hand with having these advantages. It's not easy being Bruce Wayne. The poor guy is tortured. And while it might be cheaper to get therapy, if he can afford a bat utility belt, he can certainly pay $150 an hour for a shrink, Bruce Wayne is admirable because he eschews his personal comfort in the effort to give back to the community. This is so often why the first movie in a superhero series succeeds and ones that follow don't, such as RoboCop 2. The creation myth that begins each superhero franchise stresses sympathy for the superhero's plight. Once established, filmmakers forget to recreate that sympathy and draw us into the human side of the superhero again. Spider-Man 2 avoids this mistake, and not surprisingly, was a smash hit. In truth, we will never truly understand the superhero. Indeed, our identification with him must come from sympathy for the plight of being misunderstood. If you are writing a superhero movie, a wide range of tales are available for dissection. It's a long-standing story type for a reason. It gives flight to our greatest fantasies about our potential, while tempering those fantasies with a dose of reality. Hollywood's Dirty Little Secret. I'm sure having reviewed this list of genres, you're not only seeing why so many movies are structurally identical to others, but have had many eureka moments when you're convinced that outright stealing has been perpetrated. And guess what? You're not so wrong to think that. Look at Point Break, starring Patrick Swayze. Then look at Fast and Furious. Yes, it's the same movie almost beat for beat, but one is about surfing, the other is about hot cars. Is that stealing? Is that cheating? Now look at The Matrix and compare and contrast it with the Disney Pixar hit Monsters, Inc. Yep, same movie, and there's a million more examples. Who Framed Roger Rabbit is Chinatown. Blank Check is very similar to Home Alone. In some instances, the stealing is conscious. In others, it's just coincidence. But very often, the reason it happens is that story templates work, and they work for a reason that must be repeated. Each of these movies is an example of successful storytelling. Several are huge hits. Do you think anyone is complaining that Fast and Furious ripped off the story beats of Point Break? Did anyone notice but you and me? Doubtful. The point I'm trying to get across here is it works, and it works for a reason. Because the laws of physics that govern storytelling work every time and every situation, your job is to learn why it works and how these story cogs fit together. When it seems like you're stealing, don't. When it feels like a cliche, give it a twist. When you think it's familiar, it probably is, so you've got to find a new way. But at least understand why you're tempted to use the cliche and the familiar story. The rules are there for a reason. Once you get over feeling confined by these rules, you'll be amazed at how freeing they are. True originality can't begin until you know what you're breaking away from. Summary. The topic of genre dictates the categorizing of movies. But instead of typical categories such as romantic comedy or heist movie, we've created 10 new ones that define story types. These categories are all you need for now to help you identify the story mechanics of the movie idea you're working on. You will not need to find exclusions to them. Or have I written those words prematurely? You are a screenwriter. And as I said in Chapter 1, all good screenwriters are bullheads. So I know what your response to the hard work and years of experience that went into what I've just related to you is. What about the exceptions? What about Breakfast Club? Huh? Is that rites of passage or institutionalized? Answer, institutionalized. Oh yeah, well, what about Rain Man? Is that a Golden Fleece or a Buddy Love movie? Answer, Buddy Love. Okay, smart guy, what about Ben Stiller's Zoolander? Answer, it's just a bad movie. Actually, it's one of my favorite bad movies, but it's also a great example of the superhero genre. If you're looking for the exceptions to the rules, you're missing the point of this chapter, which is to use categorizing as a storytelling tool. You must know movies. But you can't know them all, so this is a way to start. Take the script you're working on and try to find what category it's most like. Maybe you have moments in your script that borrow from all the categories. Maybe you start off your screenplay telling one type of story and end up telling another. That's fine, too. I mean, at the end of the day, I doubt you'll sell that script, but we all have to learn the hard way. We're screenwriters. Pain is the game. The point is to be well-versed in the language, rhythm, and goals of the genre you're trying to move forward. If you know what genre you're in, learn its rules and find what's essential. You'll write a better and more satisfying movie, and have a better chance to sell it. What's so great about these genres is how inspiring they are, at least to me. Seeing these genres laid out and seeing their heritage, often going back to very ancient and familiar tales, tells me that the job of give me the same thing only different is not new. Jaws is just a retelling of the ancient Greek myth of the Minotaur, or even the Dragon Slayer tales of the Middle Ages. Superman is just a modern Hercules. Road Trip is just an update of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, isn't it? To not know the roots of the story you're trying to create, either from the last 100 years of movie storytelling or the last 1,000, is to not honor the traditions and fundamental goals of your job. Give me the same thing, only different, then, is what storytelling has always been about. But it's the way we put new twists on old tales, bring them up to date, and give them a spin that's meaningful for our contemporaries. It's a skill we must master and apply to all aspects of the craft. And in the next chapter, we'll discuss how to take all this wonderful background and draw out the most important part, the hero. Exercises. 1. Pick up the movie section of your newspaper, review each of the movies available, and decide which genre they fall into. If you go see that movie, compare and contrast it with the other movies in that genre. Were you drawn to it because of the type of movie it is? 2. Grab your handy TV guide and go to the movie log lines. Going down the list to check films you've seen, write what genre each falls into. Using the categories above, simply assign a number to each movie you've seen. Does it work? Does every movie listed fall into a genre? 3. For the movie idea or script you're working on now, decide what category it falls into. Then make a list of other movies in that genre. As homework, go to your local Blockbuster and see how many of these are available. Make notes about how they compare and contrast to each other. Can you better explain what type of movie your idea or finished script is part of? 4. Finally, for those of you who love to find exceptions to the rules, make up your own genre and give it a name. Find 3 other movies in that genre. Can you find 5? Maybe you've discovered a new genre. If you come up with a brand new genre category, use my email address found in the exercise section of Chapter 1 and send it to me. If it's really a good one, I may even include it in subsequent editions of this book. Chapter 3. It's about a guy who... The next step in figuring out what your movie is about is to figure out whom it's about. As my wise old father used to say, tell me a story about a guy who... And after the concept, whenever I hear a screenwriter wind up to pitch his movie idea, somewhere in there I better hear some version of, it's about a guy who... Why is this? Well, it's like anything connected with trying to communicate an idea. The who is our way in. We, the audience, zero in on and project onto the who, whether it's an epic motion picture or a commercial for Tide detergent. The who gives us someone to identify with. And that someone doesn't even have to be human. Why do mascots and spokespeople like the Jack character and all those Jack-in-the-Box commercials, or any talking corporate icon for that matter, draw us into the story of the product being sold? It's because it's easier to communicate an idea when someone is standing there experiencing it for us. And whether we're watching Lawrence of Arabia as Lawrence tries to figure out how to attack Aqaba from the land, or a Tylenol commercial in which a busy soccer mom wonders when her headache will go away, the principle of involving us in the story is the same. As screenwriters with a great idea for a movie, the job of creating heroes that will lure an audience into our world is unique. We have to create audience stand-ins that resonate for our target market and serve the needs and goals of our story. And it starts from the very beginning with that great log line that hooks us with someone to identify with as much as something. This is why in any log line, any good log line, there will always be a couple of adjectives involved. A risk-averse teacher who, an agoraphobic stenographer who, a milquetoast banker who... This also goes for the antagonist, who now must be described as an overprotective cop, a megalomaniac terrorist, or a homicidal baker. So let's add a few things to our list of what the perfect logline must include to be truly compelling. An adjective to describe the hero, an adjective to describe the bad guy, and a compelling goal we identify with as human beings. By giving us even these thumbnail sketches of whom we are going to be following as well as the bad guy who was trying to block our hero from achieving his goal, we get a better snapshot of what is involved so we can latch onto, get interested in, and follow the story. But how are we going to do all that? How are we going to satisfy our great story and create the right characters to sell it? Who is this about? Every movie, even ensemble pieces like Pulp Fiction starring John Travolta, or Crimes and Misdemeanors starring Woody Allen, has to have a lead character. It has to be about someone. It has to have one or two main people we can focus our attention on, identify with, and want to root for, and someone who can carry the movie's theme. As important as creating this type of hero is and singling him out even if we're writing an ensemble piece, the hero isn't always the first thing we think of, or the way we come at creating a can't-lose movie idea. I hate to admit it, but I rarely begin writing any movie with the who in mind. More often, it's the idea first. And if the hero is a part of the idea, well, that's just gravy. Many will tell you differently, and this is only my approach. But I think the who has to serve the what is it, not the other way around. And once you have that golden idea, that winning pitch, that perfect hook and don't quite yet have the who, it's time to go to work to enhance the idea with the right characters, especially the hero of the story. It's all about making the what is it work better. In many cases, the key to figuring out whom this story is about and what type of person is leading the action is right there in your logline. In the scripts I've sold, many times the initial concept gave me the roadmap and all I had to do was clarify. In Poker Night, a comedy Colby Carr and I sold to Disney, the pitch is the characters. A henpecked husband finally gets the house to himself one weekend and loses it in a poker game to an unscrupulous gambler. It's risky business with a dad. Need I say more? To service that concept, all we had to do was play with the balance of the hero and the villain and make it about dad's journey from henpecked to empowered. Another comedy we came up with and sold to Universal called Third Grade has an equally simple premise. This is a story about an adult man who has to go back to third grade. After being caught in a speed trap in front of his old school, the hero is ordered by the judge to be sent back to third grade to learn some manners. Easy concept, right? But who is the best person to put in this situation? What person would offer the most comic conflict given that punishment? What hero would offer the longest journey and need to learn the biggest lesson? Any takers? Well, in the development process, it became clear. The guy who needs that lesson most is someone who has yet to grow up. On the outside, he is a successful businessman, a guy up for a promotion at his work, designing violent video games for kids. Ironic, no? But who has yet to learn the basics of human being school. This is a guy who needs to go back to third grade, but doesn't know it yet. And only this adventure will give him the comic lessons he so richly deserves. It's a sweet little movie idea. The poster is inherent in the premise. It's a guy in an Armani suit and a cell phone squeezed into a tiny desk surrounded by out-of-control 8-year-olds and maybe a kick-me sign taped to his back. Get it? Well, of course you do. But the gimmick of sending someone back to third grade wouldn't mean anything unless we figured out the perfect hero to take that journey. Amping up the logline. Many times your great initial idea will only give you a hint of what has to be done to create the hero that sells your idea best. To make the idea work, very often you have to play with the characters in order to give your hero the most conflict, the longest journey, and the most primal goal to amp up the idea for maximum impact. To make this clear, let's look at our log lines cited in Chapter 1 and tinker around with other possible who's for these ideas. In Four Christmases, all I know is that the two leads are a young couple. They both come from families of divorce and remarriage. Thus, the problem of having to see all four of their families on Christmas Day. My guess is that this is a couple that wants to be together forever, but is having problems at the get-go. They eschew their families and the problems they grew up with. They don't want to get divorced. But maybe it's not all peaches and cream. They're newlyweds. So this day will be a test for them. Do they want to go the way of their parents, or do they want to go their own way, form a permanent bond, and never get divorced? Granted, I have not read the script. I have no idea what the writers chose to do, but that's the way I'd go. And suddenly, given this very deep and primal urge, the urge to stay committed and be in love forever despite their families, this couple is worth rooting for. That's a movie I'd like to see, because those are characters I want to see win. So swiftly, this easy premise has real meaning. We have not only identified the right characters for the story, but given them a built-in alpha-omega journey to take in the course of this movie. Now, the story is the characters. And you thought it was just a funny poster. In Ride Along, part of the pitch, part of the mental picture that makes the idea crackle for me, is the adjectives. A risk-averse teacher goes on a ride along with his brother-in-law, an overprotective cop, and the goal is primal, the love of the woman they both care about. Those adjectives tell me exactly where this story is going. It's a trial by fire for the teacher. Is he brave enough to overcome his fear and win the hand of his fiancée in the real world of manly cops? If he loves her, he will. But now let's take that same ride-along idea and try some different characters in their places. What if we could do anything with this basic premise? What if the young man who is wooing the sister is not a teacher, but an ex-Green Beret? Well, now it's a different movie. It warps the way it plays out in my mind. Now, to make the comic conflict come to life, you make the cop the scaredy cat. He's Barney Fife, and his future brother-in-law will be teaching him a thing or two between reminiscences of the Gulf War and a few demonstrations of his thousand-yard stare. And odds are the ride-along would be the ex-Green Berets idea. Suddenly, it's a very different movie, isn't it? But it's another way to go. It just shows how you can have a good idea and absolutely wreck it with the wrong characters. To me, the original idea works best. In the example of the retreat, again, the adjectives come into play to tell us the writers most likely did it right. The way they have it cast now, it's about a wet-behind-the-ears, Reed Young, company employee's first taste of corporate life at a weekend retreat, and someone's trying to kill him. Funny, but let's play around with the character to see other ways they could have gone with this same premise. What if the person going on the retreat is 65, has been at the company for 20 years, and is about to retire? Okay, so now it's about a company downsizing its employees for real before they can collect their retirement benefits. Same idea, basically. A corporate retreat, a series of murder attempts, a paranoid who doesn't know why he's being targeted. But the journey's a lot different, and so is the moral, and so is the audience. No one will show up for that movie. At best, it's an indie starring Jack Lemmon, and Jack is, well, dead. The point is that amping up a great logline with the hero who makes the idea work best is how the idea comes to life. And let's be clear, the trick is to create heroes who offer the most conflict in that situation, have the longest way to go emotionally, and are the most demographically pleasing. On this last point, I have particular experience now that I'm over 40. Nowadays, I must always catch myself when thinking of my movie heroes. In my mind, everyone is 40. And the heroes in my mind, the ones that I am personally drawn to anyway, are now all existential heroes. A little world-weary, and yet bravely wise. Yeah, right. And the audience that's going to show up for that movie is, well, AWOL, to be honest. But if it gets made, the French will hail me as a genius. Whenever I find myself drifting into thinking about writing starring roles for Tim Allen, Steve Martin, or Chevy Chase, I catch myself and realize where I am. Youth-obsessed Hollywood. Those guys are fine in ensemble as part of a four-quadrant family pick. Great, but as the lead? Never. Okay, rarely. My solution, once I do catch myself and give up on trying to change things, is to make that great character with the existential dilemma a teenager, and make that married couple who's having a crisis a 20-something married couple. This is the crowd that shows up for movies. These are the heroes the audience likes to see on screen at their local Cineplex. Why fight City Hall? The age of characters I think up is my particular blind spot. You have yours. But keep in mind what our job is here. Mass market, high concept poster movies for everybody all over the world. Do not think that just because you and all your friends prefer something, or are in on a certain trend or fad, or like a type of person, that everyone else will too. I have actually been pitched a movie that the writer said was a great Julio Iglesias vehicle, I swear. Won't everybody show up for that premiere? Mucho doubto. This is why I stress getting out and pitching your movie ideas to real people in the real world to get their reaction. This discussion of blind spots reminds me of a favorite story my father used to tell. He worked in advertising early on and one time was trying to sell a client on buying TV time on Sundays. The client, a wealthy man, balked at this idea and had a very studied reason. No one stays home and watches TV on Sunday, he explained. Everyone's out playing polo. A lesson in perspective for us all. The Primal Urge. As stressed throughout this book, let me just say again, primal, primal, primal. Once you've got the hero, the motivation for the hero to succeed must be a basic one. What does X want? Well, if it's a promotion at work, it better damn well be related to winning the hand of X's beloved or saving up enough money to get X's daughter an operation. And if it's a matchup with an enemy, it better well lead to a life-or-death showdown, not just a friendly spitball fight. Why? It's because primal urges get our attention. Survival, hunger, sex, protection of loved ones, fear of death grab us. The best ideas and the best characters in the lead roles must have basic needs, wants, and desires. Basic, basic. Don't believe me? Then let's look at our three log lines and take out the primalness in each to see how our desire to see each wanes. What if in Four Christmases the lead couple isn't married? What if they're just friends who grew up together and share Christmas with each other's family every year? Same premise, but take out the sex. And what have you got? No stakes, nothing is on the line. It's still funny, it's still the same idea, but I have no primal rooting interest. Pass. In Ride Along, try taking out the sister fiancé. What if the doofus teacher just signs up for a ride along with a cop? Any cop. Well, in this gin rummy hand of primalness, I've still got survival. This teacher still has to make it through the night, and there will still be risks to his life. But having the cop's sister teacher's fiancé as the goal makes the stakes resonate with primalness. Again, as in the examples in Chapter 2, it's almost a knight-errant tale, isn't it? But having the princess as the prize makes it work, whether it's set in the modern-day hood or the Middle Ages. One more, just to grind it in. The retreat. Let's take out the danger. What if there aren't any murders? What if it's all pranks, played on the newbie executive? Well, where are the stakes? To make this idea work, you must have a threat of death, otherwise it's a corporate training film. Or worse, an existential metaphor. And yes, this is all about your hero. Give him stakes, real stakes, primal stakes. Stakes that are basic, that we understand. Make the hero want something real and simple. Survival, hunger, sex, protection of loved ones, fear of death. And when it comes to who to cast in your screenplay, we respond best to stories of husbands and wives, fathers and daughters, mothers and sons, ex-boyfriends and girlfriends. Why? Because we all have these people in our lives. You say father, and I see my father. You say girlfriend, and I see my girlfriend. We all have him, and he gets our attention because of that. It's an immediate attention getter, because we have a primal reaction to those people. To those words, even. So when in doubt, ground your characters in the most deep-seated imagery you can. Make it relevant to us. Make it something that every caveman and his brother will get. Make it. Say it with me now. Primal. Casting for the role of your hero. One of the pitfalls of being a savvy movie writer is knowing who among the acting set is looking to do what part next. Adam wants to do a drama next, to get his Oscar nod. Ditto Jim, ditto Steve. After Lost in Translation, ditto everybody. We have also seen everyone's most recent movie, may or may not know what's in production next, and think we know who'd be perfect for the movie we are writing. Let me state here and now, we do not know. This is all a long way of saying, don't cast the movie before you've sold the script. Don't write parts for certain actors. Don't get married to the idea of one particular actor doing the part. You'll always be disappointed. Rare is the occasion when dream script meets dream cast. And let me give you an example of learning the hard way. The amazing Sheldon Bull and I wrote a hilarious comedy in 2004. What if the president's helicopter goes down behind enemy lines? And what if he is forced to capture Osama bin Laden all by himself? That was our premise. It's about a president who finds his inner leader. It's Galaxy Quest with George W. Bush. Great, huh? We even had a great title, Chicken Hawk Down. And here's why we did not sell that script. Because there are about two people who can play the part of the president. It's the lead. And there really isn't anyone out there who can open that movie. Tim Allen was our first choice, and who else? What we had done was paint ourselves into a corner on casting. Yes, it's funny. Yes, it's a great story. Yes, someday it will get made, by God. But right now, it just sits there. Hear the crickets? We are professional screenwriters, and we should have known better. But we got so caught up in our idea, see, that we didn't think it all the way through. The point is to leave yourself plenty of room for casting. Your leads should be able to be played by many actors and actresses, and they should all be able to open the movie. This is yet another reason why young actors are in such demand. There's so damn many of them. And no, you do not know what parts actors are looking for, even if you hear it from their manager. Even if the actor looks you in the eye and tells you that their next movie, the role he really wants, is a comedy where he plays a teacher. He is lying. He is an actor. Lovely, charming people to be sure, but skittish as thoroughbreds. They do not know what they want to do next, and neither do you. Actor archetypes. That said, why is it that certain actors always play certain parts over and over again? As hinted at in Chapter 2, you find throughout cinema history that many of the big stars play one part really well. Think about Marilyn Monroe, Clark Gable, Cary Grant. Now think about Jim Carrey, Russell Crowe, Julia Roberts, and Sandra Bullock. It's not because these are not good actors who can't do more than one type of role, only that what makes movies work to a large degree is our need to be shown certain archetypes on screen. And the actors who play these archetypes now are just taking the place of the actors who played the same archetypes years ago. Isn't Russell Crowe Errol Flynn, even geographically? Isn't Jim Carrey Jerry Lewis? Isn't Tom Hanks Jimmy Stewart? Isn't Sandra Bullock Rosalind Russell? The reason is that these archetypes exist to satisfy our inner need to see these shadow creations in our brains played out on screen. It's the Jungian archetypes these actors represent that we're interested in seeing. And if you always remember to write for the archetype and not the star, the casting will take care of itself. So while this may not be strictly Jungian, even though I got an A in Jung, let me instead give you some Snyderian archetypes for your perusal. There's the young man on the rise archetype, a very American character that includes Harold Lloyd, Steve Martin in his day, Adam Sandler, and the omniversal Ashton Kutcher. Horatio Alger-esque, a little dumb but plucky, this is the type we all want to see win. There's the good girl tempted archetype, pure of heart, cute as a bug, Betty Grable, Doris Day, Meg Ryan in her day, Reese Witherspoon. This is the female counterpart of the young man on the rise. There's the imp, the clever and resourceful child, Jackie Coogan, Macaulay Culkin, and even their evil opposite, the bad seed, i.e. Patty McCormick. There's the sex goddess archetype, Mae West to Marilyn Monroe to Brigitte Bardot to Halle Berry. And the male version, the hunk, from Rudolph Valentino to Clark Gable, from Robert Redford to Tom Cruise to Viggo Mortensen to Mr. and Mrs. Diesel's pride and joy, Vin. And the list goes on. There's the wounded soldier going back for a last redemptive mission archetype, Paul Newman and now Clint Eastwood. There's the troubled sexpot archetype, Veronica Lake, Angelina Jolie. And the lovable fop, Cary Grant, Hugh Grant. There's the court jester, Danny Kaye, Woody Allen, Rob Schneider. There's the wise grandfather, Alec Guinness, and now, same beard, same robe, Ian McKellen. There are magic dwarves and tricksters, sidekicks and talking animals, spinsters and wizards, Falstaffs and misers, and they keep on popping up, over and over again. Same characters, same function for being in the story. Like knowing the history of certain story types, knowing the long line of ancestors your characters descend from is a must. You don't have to be Joseph Campbell to see that no matter who's hot and casting call, the archetypes never change. Each one of these archetypes has a story arc we want to see played out again and again. And it's all about matching what we carry in the back of our minds to what we see on screen. Who deserves to win and why? Who deserves comeuppance and why? And despite the dictates of political correctness, fashion, and fad, we still want to see justice meted out for characters we hate and victory granted to those we admire. The stories of these heroes and the mathematical equations that make their stories work is already sewn into our DNA. Your job, your simple task, is to forget the stars, concentrate on the archetypes, and strive to make them new. Special circumstances. And now, for my bullheads in the audience, let's get to the exceptions. When it comes to creating the linear, straightforward movie hero, we pretty much understand. But what about the special circumstances? What about ensemble? What about biographical movies? What about animated movies where the characters come from non-relevant fairy tales? Okay. Yes, there are always special circumstances. But finding the hero in all of these examples is the same method used to find them in any original, one-line, or spec. Take biography. You've been handed someone's life story and now have to make a movie out of it. So what if the hero isn't necessarily very likable? Or what if he or she did things that weren't all that admirable? What then? Let's take a look at Kinsey. Those of you who know the story about the famous sex study pioneer Alfred Kinsey know that the screenwriter, also the director Bill Condon, faced a problem. Kinsey was odd. He conducted sex studies on friends and neighbors, spied on his wife, and dabbled with his subjects in ways many might think of as objectionable. Finding the hero in that story also means finding a bad guy, too. But if they can make a movie out of the life of pornmeister Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler magazine, as they did in The People vs. Larry Flint, and make him out to be a hero, well, why not follow the same formula? And that's exactly what Condon did. The writers of A Beautiful Mind faced the same problem with mathematician John Nash and chose to simply fudge some of the facts of his life story to make him more palatable. They dropped certain unheroic facets of his love life and merged two real wives into one for the sake of movie continuity. This kind of thing, with the guidance of a good errors and omissions attorney, is done a lot. I myself grappled with a similar dilemma when I was handed the biographical challenge of John DeLorean, the famous automaker and creator of the DeLorean sports car. Imagine my surprise when my research proved him not to be a Tucker-esque maverick brought down by the big three automakers for his radical ideas, but by some accounts a con man. All well and good, but who's the hero in that story? My solution was to make the hero the author of one of the books I'd read, a guy who had been inside the DeLorean empire from the start and grew disillusioned by both the man and his vision. By tracing the rise and fall of DeLorean from this insider's point of view and showing how he could be fooled, it gave the audience the way into that story. I even gave my script the ironic title Dream Car. Your way into a biography has to pay attention to the same rules of any story. It has to be first and foremost about a guy who we can root for, or at least understand. Ensemble pieces can offer the same dilemma for the screenwriter. And as the examples of John Travolta in Pulp Fiction and Woody Allen in Crimes and Misdemeanors prove, the hero doesn't always have to be the one with the most scenes. But ensemble does offer a unique challenge of finding your way in. Who is this about, you keep asking? This piece with 12 characters, all with equal screen time? One of the masters of the ensemble, director Robert Altman, specializes in this. Nashville, Welcome to L.A., and Shortcuts offer crisscrossing character sketches with no central lead. But Altman would argue differently. The city of Nashville became the star of Nashville, and Shortcuts and Welcome to L.A. stars the city of Los Angeles. Granted, these are not classic heroes' tales, but Altman found his way in and stuck to it. And by creating a new kind of hero to root for, he was true to the moral he wanted to tell. In ensemble, like any story, the hero is usually the one who carries the theme of the movie. When in doubt, ask yourself who serves this function in your movie, who comes up against the others the hardest, and who grows the most. And pretty soon you're asking the same questions you ask when finding the hero of any movie you're writing. Who offers the most conflict? Who comes the farthest emotionally? And who is the most likable? The one we want to root for and see win. That's the one you have to make it about. Animated tales based on existing material are often difficult challenges, especially when translating across cultural differences and time. Later we will see how the hero of Disney's Aladdin went from being an unlikable street urchin in the original text, though one who was perfectly acceptable to the culture in which he was created, to an affable modern surfer dude. Likewise, in Disney's Mulan, Pocahontas, and The Hunchback of Notre Dame, the writers were presented with similar challenges and met with mixed results based on changes to the hero and how his or her story was told. But whether your cast of characters is a pack of prehistoric ice agers or a bunch of idiosyncratic insects, ants, A Bug's Life, the process of giving us a winning logline and the hero to star in it is exactly the same. The rule of thumb in all these cases is to stick to the basics no matter what. Tell me a story about a guy who I can identify with, I can learn from, I have compelling reason to follow, I believe deserves to win, and has stakes that are primal and ring true for me. Follow that simple prescription for finding the hero of your movie, then you can't go wrong. No matter what assignment, material, or sweeping canvas has been handed to you, you find the hero by finding the heart of the story. Slave to the logline. When you have found the perfect hero for your story and nailed down just what his primal goal is, it's time to go back to your logline and add in what you've learned to make it perfect. And if it sounds like I'm insisting that you become a slave to the logline, well, you're right. The logline is your story's code, its DNA, the one constant that has to be true. If it's good, if it has all the earmarks of a winning idea, then it should give you everything you need to guide you in writing the screenplay. It is, in short, the touchstone, both for you, the writer, and the audience you're selling your movie to. If you are true to your logline, you will deliver the best possible story. And if you find yourself straying from it in the middle of the writing process, you better have a good reason. And this is particularly true when it comes to your hero. The logline tells the hero's story, who he is, who he's up against, and what's at stake. The nice, neat form of a one- or two-sentence pitch tells you everything. Nailing it down and sticking to it is not only a good exercise, it will become vital to your story as you continue to beat it out and eventually write it. By examining who your hero is and what his primal goal is, as well as the bad guy who was trying to stop him from achieving that goal, you can better identify and expand on the needs of your story. The logline with the most conflict, the most sharply defined hero and bad guy, and the clearest, most primal goal is the winner. And once you identify those characteristics and it works, stick to it. Use that logline to double-check your results as you begin to execute your screenplay. And if you find a better way in the writing, make sure you go back and re-enunciate it. But from beginning to end, making it about a guy who keeps you on track. And the logline helps you continue to double-check your math from initial concept to fade out. Summary. Finding the hero of your story is the second most important part of coming up with a winning movie concept. Winning meaning one that will sell. Cast and concept is, in fact, the starting point of getting any movie made. What's it about and who's in it are the first two questions any moviegoer asks. And that goes for everyone else as well, from agent and producer to studio executive. It's how the who and the what is it come together in an intriguing combination that makes us want to see this story unfold. The perfect hero is the one who offers the most conflict in the situation, has the longest emotional journey, and has a primal goal we can all root for. Survival, hunger, sex, protection of loved ones, and fear of death grab us. It is usually someone we can identify with primally too, and that's why mothers and daughters, fathers and sons, brothers and sisters, husbands and wives make better characters than mere strangers facing the same situations and storylines. When committing these discoveries to your logline, you must have an adjective to describe the hero, an adjective to describe the bad guy, and a definite and primal goal, or setting. Exercises. 1. Review your list of movies in the genre you're trying to execute and write out the logline for each. Give attention and great adjectives to the type of hero, the type of bad guy, and the hero's primal goal. 2. What actor archetypes can you identify from the list of movies in your genre? What type of character is the lead portraying, and what actors from the past could play those parts as well as the modern-day star? 3. Name an ensemble movie and identify its hero. Does every movie have to have a hero? Name other movies where the story required no main hero. 4. Finally, if you feel really daring, try writing a logline for this idea. A guy gets a talking car. Knowing what you know about how to amp up the hero, the bad guy, and the primal goal, write a logline for that idea. And make sure you use adjectives that grab us. Chapter 4. Let's beat it out. Itching to start writing your screenplay? Of course you are. Will I let you start writing your screenplay? Keep itching. But you certainly are getting closer. And think about all that you've accomplished so far. You polished your one line and pitched enough civilians to know you've got a good one. You've screened a dozen movies that are in the category of story you're trying to tell. You've come up with a perfect hero and antagonist and amped up both the hero's primal goal and the conflict in the way of his achieving it. And now it's time to take all that great info you've gleaned about your script and figure out how to write the sucker. There is no greater thrill when I am working on a newly born movie idea than the battle cry, "Let's beat it out!" It means it's time to put all those great scenes and ideas and characters up on the board and see what goes where, which character does what, and whether you need every scene you've imagined or have to invent all new ones. It's time to do the measure twice, cut once calculation that will save you time, allow you to pitch beat for beat, and build the foundation and ironwork of your screenplay. It's time to talk about structure. Structure, structure, structure. After coming up with the idea and identifying the who in your movie and who it's for, the structure is the single most important element in writing and selling a screenplay. Good structure is ironclad. And when you sell your script, having a well-structured screenplay will show that you have really done the work and making a blueprint that is solid and sound. That credit jumpers can change the order of your scenes, they can erase your dialogue, they can add new characters and take others away, and they will. But if you've done the work on structure and know how and why your story works, no matter how they tinker, your screenplay will remain strong. It will remain yours. Not to get too self-protective, but a strong structure guarantees your writing credit. More than any other element, the bones of a screenplay, as constructed in the story beats of your script, will be proof to those who decide who gets credit at the Writers Guild of America, WGA, that the work is primarily yours. Talk to any writer whose credit has been arbitrated, and they'll tell you. For a spec screenwriter, you're guaranteed that you stay in the picture, and that the fabulous cash and prizes called residuals, which come in lovely lime green envelopes at the most unexpected and welcome times, will be yours. The craftsmanship it takes, the patient work, the magic of storytelling on film, all come together in how you execute and realize structure. It is a skill you must know. I came to structure, slowly and late, and mostly I came to it out of desperation. How many meetings did I go to early on where I pitched my movie idea by giving the exec the concept, a few cool scenes, and then simply stopped and smiled because I had nowhere else to go? God, I remember the first time I was hired to write a screenplay, and the executive asked me about my act break. I had exactly zero idea of what this nice person was talking about. This was before I'd even heard about Sid Field, whom I consider to be the father of the modern movie template. And when I finally read and digested Field's opus screenplay, I knew I had found something truly career-saving. Oh, three acts! Imagine that! And yet it was not enough. Like a swimmer in a vast ocean, there was a lot of open water in between those two act breaks, and a lot of empty script space in which to get lost, panic, and drown. I needed more islands, shorter swims. Vicki King filled in a lot more of that open water for me in a book with the unlikely get-rich-quick title of How to Write a Movie in 21 Days. And yet, even with midpoints and B-stories, there was still way too much room to screw up. So I developed my own. From what I'd seen in movies, read about in screenplay books, and found myself relying on, I developed the Blake Snyder beat sheet. I wrote out 15 beats and managed to squeeze them all in on a one-page document on which the 15 islands would fit. Flush left. It looks like this. The Blake Snyder beat sheet. Project title, genre, date. 1. Opening image, page 1. 2. Theme stated, page 5. 3. Setup, pages 1 through 10. 4. Catalyst, page 12. 5. Debate, pages 12 through 25. 6. Break into 2, page 25. 7. B story, page 30. 8. Fun and games, pages 30 to 55. 9. Midpoint, page 55. 10. Bad guys close in, page 55 to 75. 11. All is lost, page 75. 12. Dark Night of the Soul, pages 75 to 85. 13, break into three, page 85. 14, finale, pages 85 to 110. 15, final image, page 110. Isn't this pure and easy? I use this simple one-page blank form whenever I have a pitch meeting. I won't let myself go into that meeting until I've filled in every space, and there aren't that many spaces. You can only write one, maybe two sentences explaining where each beat is, and that's perfect. Like the one-line description of the movie as a whole, I learned that if I can't fill in the blank in one or two sentences, I don't have the beat yet. I am just guessing. I'm treading water, about to drown. Yet it isn't until I work on the form and try to fill in those blank spaces that I even know I have a problem. The numbers in parentheses are the page numbers where the beats take place. A script in terms of page count should be about as long as a good jockey weighs, 110. Though some dramas run longer, the proportions are the same. I want my act breaks, midpoints, and all is lost moments to hit their marks, and I insist they do. Take a look at Blank Check, where 5 minutes into the movie, roughly page 5 of the script, the theme is stated loud and clear. Look at where the midpoint, the all is lost and break into three, hit. They're perfect, and stayed that way from script to screen because Colby and I worked our butts off to make it so from the first draft of that script to the last. It worked because our structure was sound, and we had tried it from every angle to make sure it was sound. It defied those who wanted to override us because we had nailed the structure. Some of these terms may be unfamiliar to you. What, you may ask, is fun and games? Well, that's my name for it, and not to worry, it's found in both dramas and comedies. What is the dark night of the soul? Again, another eureka, but a beat you've seen about a million times. The codifying of these beats is now available to you anytime. The Blake Snyder Beat Sheet, the BS2, is here to help. But before you go off half-baked, or all-baked for that matter, let me explain and give examples of what I mean by each section of the screenplay as outlined in this form. Do you have a choice in this matter? No, you do not. Opening image, page 1. The very first impression of what a movie is, its tone, its mood, the type and scope of the film, are all found in the opening image. I can think of many great ones. The reckless motorcycle ride through the English countryside leading to the death of Lawrence of Arabia. The gated looming castle behind which lurks the mysterious Citizen Kane. And even silly ones like the opening image of Animal House. Who could forget the motto of Faber College, "Knowledge is good," beneath the statue of the Faber College founder. Don't we know what we're in for with all three of these examples? Don't each of these opening images set the tone, type, style, and stakes of the movie as a whole? The opening image is also an opportunity to give us the starting point of the hero. It gives us a moment to see a before snapshot of the guy or gal, or a group of people we are about to follow in this adventure we're all going to take. Presumably, if the screenwriter has done his job, there will also be an after snapshot to show how things have changed. Like many of the beats on the BS2, the opening image has a matching beat, the final image. These are bookends. And because a good screenplay is about change, these two scenes are a way to make clear how that change takes place in your movie. The opening and final images should be opposites, a plus and a minus, showing change so dramatic it documents the emotional upheaval that the movie represents. Often actors will only read the first and last 10 pages of a script to see if that drastic change is in there and see if it's intriguing. If you don't show that change, the script is often tossed across the room into the reject pile. So the opening image does a lot. It sets the tone, mood, and style of the movie, and very often introduces the main character and shows us a before snapshot of him or her. But mostly what it does is get us to scrunch down in our seats in the movie theater and say, "This is going to be good." And since you've just screened a dozen movies like the one you're about to write, you can think of at least 6 that have standout opening images. All good movies have them. Theme stated.